pathologists used to cream off the top of the fees of the testing laboratories. As much as $500,000 a piece for doing nothing except certifying that the laboratory was okay. And the medical technologists, of whom there are thousands, revolted. And the Congress gave them relief. They prohibited the skimming operation. That's the kind of thing, getting down to the nitty-gritty, that will help what you have in mind.
What was the role of the medical community in shaping a lot of the legislation that you were involved with?
Well, for a long time, it was dragged, screaming and hauling the other way into these matters. But a growing number of doctors have served to somewhat abate the monopolistic attitude of the doctors. I don't even say the profession. I just say the doctors. But we've got a long way to go. And I might say that the medical schools may administer a Hippocratic oath, but unlike the law schools, have not yet made a cardinal principle of the obligation of a doctor, like the lawyer, to devote some portion of his or her skill and time to the public service. And I think that's a grave deficiency. And stands in urgent need of correction. They are still a young man or woman has a big change when they get that license in terms of outlook and dedication. It's not by any means universal. There's still a hell of a lot of it around.
I had a question about style. In reading through your autobiography, I was impressed that you rarely use pork barrel politics in any of the negotiations through your many years in Congress. And I wonder if you could give me some idea of what styles you think would work best in the coming years for bringing health legislation to the fore.
There are three styles in Congress. There's one style is to serve your constituents as if you were a devoted runner of errands. And many members establish a very important hold on their constituents that way. The other style, old-fashioned politics, is trading back scratching. And the last style is to have confidence in the essential probity of a majority and to pursue by means of being extremely well prepared yourself, and then by persuasion, your objectives. The last is the toughest. And I'm asked often, having served for so long, what do I think is happening to the Congress since World War II? I think on the whole, its members are better informed and more traveled and have more intelligent constituencies which are willing to support intelligence and genuine ability and unbelievably hard work. If I wanted to be maudlin, I would say I'm a casualty. And on the record, considering the days and hours and activity that I've put in, I have nothing to complain about.
Directly related to health care, but...
What time is it?
7 minutes to three.
So much. Go ahead.
There's a lot of attention paid to pension planning. There's a little bit more attention paid to pension planning at present than there was in the past, and I know that you were highly involved in ERISA legislation.
I was the architect of ERISA.
And I wondered what you see the future for me. Where do you see us heading with legislation?
I think its future is very secure. Its fruits in personal investment for security in all the years, which include insurance and IRAs, Keel plans, are very, very helpful. And it's a tremendous, vital development to deal with the inadequacy of Social Security. And it also has created the biggest pool of capital known to man already. There are $900 billion in pension funds. Now, we are learning how to use them very slowly, intelligently. The big issues of social investment, that is, well, the building construction workers should be encouraged to put their pension funds into moderate income housing, which is a very evident thing. It will remain to be decided. And I'm the chairman of the celebration of the first decade of ERISA, which will be dealt with in Washington in September. The bill was signed on Labor Day in 1974. But it's a true and exciting expression of self-help and mutual cooperation. It covers 45 million workers today, and it's terribly gratifying and very important to our country. Anything else? Anything else?
Senator, you described HMOs as the wave
of the future. Right.
To what extent are you personally convinced of the efficacy of HMOs? You mentioned the open enrollment debate. There are others that argue that the effectiveness of HMOs is subject to question. I've heard some people argue, for example, that they don't save money so much on preventative care as in making decisions on tests or using personnel at levels that might affect the quality of health care. I just wondered how you felt about that debate at this point in time.
Well, I think that the HMO is very promising because their objectives are the genius of insurance. Not everybody gets sick at the same time, and they operate without the unbelievable overhead of insurance, which you know, we see these ads about your insurance agent and so on. All this adds on to the cost. You know, you're paying for every ad you see on TV. There's no free lunch in this society. So the HMOs are one, very cooperative, and very, therefore, have the best hope for economy on the insurance principle. And second, they do have a preventive care objective, and that's the big deficiency which we face in terms of health and health care costs. I mean, anybody will tell you that if people stop smoking, they stop gaining undue amounts of weight. Look around you. See how many Americans are overweight. And at 50 are breaking down. And we're very proud of our longevity of roughly 73 or 4 years of age. You know, and I know that unless we are wiped out by the atomic bomb, there will be tremendous leaps forward in life expectancy and in the coming decades that could be enormously accelerated by preventive health care. So I'm very high on HMO and comparable plans. It's not the only one by any means. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am breaking into the history department and will continue with another lecture Thursday also. I gather it's the history. Professor Leibowitz suggested this subject of the presidents. It's a matter of great interest to me because I've served with every president since Harry Truman, and I also have made a major effort in the Congress to curb presidents and to express the independence of the Congress as a coordinate arm of government. I have the greatest respect, indeed, reverence for the office. I know the awesomeness of the decisions which that individual, who's also a very human being, must make. But I've never let that overween my conviction that the Congress, like the judiciary, must be independent and defer to no president in pursuance of its own responsibility. An amusing story on that is that I came to the House of Representatives in 1947 with then Jack Kennedy, Massachusetts, and the first bill we introduced, being both of us veterans of World War II and members of a rather liberal veterans organization called the American Veterans Committee, introduced the housing, Veterans Housing Act of 47. And we have in my family, and it contains as a matter of fact in my autobiography, a picture of Jack and myself offering this bill. He looked like a college freshman. I was a rather bald college sophomore or junior. And of course, I always called him Jack. And when he was elected president, I came to see him, something or other. And I said, "Mr. President," he looked up in great surprise. And I said, "That's the way it's got to be. That's how I feel about the presidency." So that's the key to my analysis of these presidents, which I'll give you shortly. And it's also the key to my view about the Congress and its place in our system. In the lexicon of Washington, there is such a thing as a Senate man. And there are a few they qualify highly. And one of them became president, Lyndon Johnson. But that's the way I was. And there are other prototypes way back in history who feel as I do about the presidency. Reverence, but not submission. And hence, I consider the one of the great things I did as a senator, the authorship, and an icon of the War Powers Resolution of 1973 over Nixon's veto, which is the only law on the books of the United States which restrains a president, or seeks to, if the Congress has the guts to apply it, in using his authority, constitutionally, as commander-in-chief, to put the nation into war. By the way, the troops of our country are deployed, notwithstanding the fact that the Constitution gives the Congress the exclusive authority, quote, to declare war. And nowadays, you don't declare war, you're just in it. Now, the presidents. I served under Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Carter, Ford, and even Reagan. I spent a year in the State Department, though I was not successful in the campaign of 1980, which would have been my fifth term, and I would have become chairman of the Committee on Foreign Relations. But as I describe it in my autobiography, the Lord showed me a promised land, would not allow me to enter. And that, as you can understand, I have very good company. Let's start with Truman. He was a machine politician out of the Crump machine in his native Missouri, but a man of extraordinary tenacity, determination, conviction, patriotism, and vision. And he proves everything one can say about not writing off an able, dedicated, exciting leader, because he is a politician. It doesn't make it wrong, and doesn't make him some debased character. And yet that word, politician, has a very unfortunate connotation. Truman was the arch politician. He was also, far and away, the best president in contemporary times. Now, why? One, he was not upstaged by Churchill and Stalin. They were pretty hard guys not to be upstaged by. But he held his own with great tenacity and showed an ability to learn about the world, which gave birth to the finest efforts of our country since World War II. The Marshall Plan, which brought Europe back from disintegration, and you really had to be over it, but to see it, as I did as an Army officer, in order to understand how prostrate Europe was and how torn down and destroyed, in fact and spirit. And he was the author, at least in his name, of Point 4 for technical assistance to depressed countries. He had a deep understanding of what you do about productive people in who are vanquished in war. Thought about the fact that they well deserved to be, but he kept the Allies from making the mistake which the Allies made at the end of World War I in imposing such a burden of reparations and adverse conditions as to brought on the desperation which produced Hitler. Let's never forget that. And the Morgenthau Plan, Morgenthau was one of our leading statesmen and the former ambassador to Germany, and later his son became Secretary of the Treasury. The Morgenthau Plan was to make Germany a pasture, literally, make it farm country, dismantle its industry, etc. I had a great deal to do with Truman on that subject, and he showed an extraordinary amount of understanding, very well briefed on the subject, and stood firmly against such a reactionary policy. Now we must also give him great credit for the beginning of desegregation in the armed forces, which even in World War II was practically thoroughly segregated. It personally experience myself as an officer. Shocking. Now you must remember also that he was a very feisty, very big fighter, as he showed in the teeth of adversity, coming back to defeat Governor Dewey in New York, a 20-1 favorite to win the election of 48. And Truman, picking on just the right target, the so-called 80th Congress, which he fought against as a reactionary. It was Republican dominated, and he beat him because he was such a fighter. But history has yet to decide whether all of these virtues, strengths, great contributions were superior to his decision to drop the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Probably it was inevitable, and if we hadn't done it, the other side would. Nevertheless, it was kind of a decision which makes men shudder. And I'll tell you this, though, from my personal experience with him, he had no doubt about it.